Real 7. We were talking about when you did your examinations for a sub-lieutenant as a midshipman. What do you remember of the examinations, the sort of thing you had to go through?
My main concern was that my results in those examinations would affect my seniority as a sub-lieutenant. The ship had to certify that I was competent in the seamanship roles, navigation, boat handling, and so on, that I knew about gunnery, something about gunnery, something about electrics and torpedoes, something about engineering, and that I had reached a satisfactory standard as an officer, let's say taking charge of things and doing what I was told to do and working with the ratings. And so the opinions were expressed in the results as to how well or how badly I'd done in these things. And I vividly remember, because I was never terribly brilliant at mathematics, that the instructor lieutenant who had taught me ship construction and stability curves and all that sort of thing commented on the fact that I wasn't brilliant at that, but I was very good at hockey. The reports I got otherwise as an officer were entirely satisfactory, if not slightly better than that. And so I was much relieved to get away with it. So I hadn't done as much swatting under the conditions where we were constantly on watch or whatever, as perhaps one would have done in peacetime.
So what happened after the examinations were on board
The
the
examination on board, was one capable of going forward to do the longer courses in these various similar subjects ashore? In fact, were we jumping from the stage of being a midshipman to being sub-lieutenant, acting sub-lieutenants? And so it was said we were good enough for that, and we were put ashore before Christmas 1941. We then had to go to the gunnery school at Whale Island.
What do you remember of that course?
That was mostly parade ground stuff and learning how to do gun drill in batteries there, shouted at by gunner's mates who were very fierce and expected everything to be done perfectly. But the more interesting one was being taught how to fire a revolver, which was the 45 revolver at that stage, 45 Colt, I think, which kicked like a donkey in your hand, and to do it not in the traditional way of standing up straight, as one often sees in papers and pictures, moving pictures, which is the way in which perhaps shooting someone who'd been rude to you and you were having a duel with them might be done. But what was called the Shanghai range, which was to do it in semi-darkness at targets which suddenly dropped out from the wall in the semi-darkness, and to learn to shoot rather quickly and in a crouch. The reason for that was that invasion was expected, and we spent a certain amount of time, while under instruction, nevertheless patrolling the place at night in case there were going to be paratroops or whatever. So war was not always that far away, and although our courses were much shorter than they would have been in peacetime, they were pretty intensive.
They had the gunnery course. What other courses? You were at Rodine.
Rodine was a torpedo course. HMS Vernon at Portsmouth had not only been bombed, but it was also doing many other things. And so we were sent to the girls' school at Rodine, which had been taken over by the Navy. And some flats locally had been taken over by the Navy to accommodate the sub-lieutenants. But my mother and John Lake's mother decided to come down and be with us for that fortnight. And so we lived at the Neville House Hotel on the front at Brighton and went up every day to Rodine. Those who had been there initially had spent a lot of time enjoying the fact that they were in a girls' school, I think. Not because there were any girls there, but because the dormitories contained bells, which were marked, if you want a mistress in the night, ring the bell. And it was a little while before these bells were disconnected. Everybody wanted to ring the bell. We were also occasionally attacked by Focke-Wulf 190s, which were making singleton runs across the channel and dropping the odd bomb in the flats where the sub-lieutenants were, in fact, accommodated. My time down in Brighton was considerably enlivened by the fact that John Lake's sister was a masseuse and working in the local hospital. Physiotherapist is probably a better word for it these days. And I was damaged playing hockey and needed to be rubbed. And I fell violently in love with Joan Lake, which added to the excitement of being subaltern on shore for once, as opposed to being midshipman at sea, which we had been for the previous 18 months. The lady's name will crop up again later on.
What was the actual torpedo course?
Mostly electrics, and also trying to learn how to work a torpedo in the dark. You had to be able to do things in the dark to it, which seemed to me to be wildly improbable at the time. And I wasn't awfully good at it, perhaps that's why I thought it was improbable. But I duly qualified. I didn't get first-class results in all the things like my friends John Lake and Ray McCaig did, contemporaries of mine.
Any other courses?
Navigators, yes, navigation
course.
Where was that? That was done no longer at the navigation school, but a rather lovely country house outside Portsmouth, just over the hills, past the Napoleonic forts on top of the hills outside Portsmouth, where, surprisingly, the pheasants used to come and peck away at the food just outside the French windows where we were having our rather luxurious country house meals. Again, I was better at learning something about how operations worked there under the navigators, but spherical trigonometry had never been my strongest subject. But we weren't there for very long.
Any other courses?
We also learned anti-submarine warfare, but we were not sent to the main school of anti-submarine warfare because they were too busy training the real warriors to go in rather than subalterns. But we learned the theory of it, and we went to sea in something and saw how it happened. This was particularly the use of the ASDEC, the anti-submarine detection investigating something, which the Americans subsequently called sonar. And so we now all call it sonar, don't we? But we invented it, never let it be forgotten. High frequency echo detection. We were very concerned about how well we'd done the courses because it gave us seniority, and also about which our next appointment would be. And eventually, having had a fortnight's leave as well, I was appointed to HMS Tartar and told to join up in Hull.
And was that regarded as a good result?
Well, my results were certainly satisfactory. I wasn't brilliant, but I was very lucky to be appointed to this marvellous ship. And this was very much to be desired from my point of view. Some of my friends were sent back to big ships and they didn't really think that was a good idea. They would have preferred to go to something like Tartar.
And you joined at Hull. Would that be in March? You said
I was meant to join in Hull. I joined, in fact, in June. And I was meant to join on my 21st birthday. By inquiring when the ship was going to sea, I found, in fact, that she had been driven rather too fast into a big sea somewhere in the north, and that the forecastle had dropped several inches, and that she'd been under refit for a long time, and that when I would join the subalternant, I would be the captain of Tartar, surprisingly, because there's only one other officer on board, and he was a gunner. So I rang the ship and say I was delayed in joining my 24 hours and had my 21st birthday party in London, which was very exciting for two reasons. One was my brother, who'd been evacuated from Dunkirk, had a job in the War Office, and more importantly, he had a bedroom in one of the lovely hotels there where they'd always put up an extra bed for me if I happened to be in London. So I had somewhere to stay. Secondly, being a Sunday, the Officers' Club dance in the ballroom of the Grosvenor Hotel was running, and therefore my girlfriend could come up to that. And thirdly, there were enough of my family around to give me lunch in the Mirabel as a major party, which I was looking forward to enormously. the chaos of war and all the rest of it was such that Mother, who had been living in Bexhill in 1939-40, by the time the invasion scare came, the authority had said it was a bad thing to be done in Bexhill because barbed wire was going to be put along our front of our house, which was on the sea, and that she should move if possible. So she moved to her sister's house in North London, which of course then came under the bombing attacks on London, which was much more dangerous. I had been particularly worried because my Sheffield was a Chatham ship, and the raids up the Thames estuary had killed the families of many of the sailors on board. And in those circumstances, I was worried about Mother, and I expressed concern about Mother, who wrote to me and said, well, she was now doing a job. She was working on a canteen on the gun site on Hampstead Heath, and the poor soldiers working the guns needed food in the middle of the night, didn't they? She was perfectly all right. She said she'd bought a very large frying pan. She held it over her head on the way back home because it kept the shrapnel off. Well, I had committed a grave error as a junior and stupid midshipman in Sheffield by handing a letter addressed to Able Seaman, somebody or other, care of the captain, when I was duty officer, when it came at Gibraltar. And I gave it straight to the man. They told him his family had been rubbed out, and it should have been given to him in much better ways. So I was very conscious of the risk to civilians in that sense, too. So we've got to the point where I was appointed to Tartar, and I went up to Hull. And we weren't going to sea for several weeks because the officers hadn't joined yet. The refit was winding to an end, and I didn't really understand what was going on because I wasn't that important to it or indeed experienced enough. So we were in the hands of people ashore anyway for this. And I found that a friend of my godmother's was playing at the local playhouse there, Evelyn Lay, who was quite a well-known song and dance actress at the time. So I both took a local wren along to the theatre to watch her do the performance and then invited her back to the ship. Well, by then, the captain had been appointed, St. John Tyrwhitt, and some of the other officers had been appointed. And I think it made quite a splash that a famous musical artist should have been invited back. And we were obviously knitting together, I now see, as a wardroom extremely well. And the captain, Hands were still slightly shaking from his previous experience as captain of Juno at Crete, where he'd been surrounded by a patent bomber and his ship had sunk in 3 or 4 minutes and he'd swum off his own bridge. He'd spent 6 months in the operations division and badgered everybody to get him back to sea as soon as possible. His father had been a famous admiral commanding the Dover Patrol in the First World War, I think. Well, he was a bachelor. He was a marvellous leader. I admired him enormously as a sub-lieutenant, and I became the gunnery officer.
What was so good about him?
The word I've learnt since then was charisma. He had the gift of being very firm, very clear, and the sort of man you'd trust. And quite clearly, everybody trusted him, though they were a bit frightened of him. In my role as his gunnery officer, controlling more guns than any other destroyer had, except of that class, I was a very important cog in the wheel of fighting the ship. And he was absolutely determined that he was going to educate me as a mere sub-lieutenant into doing things the way he wanted, with the result that I was quite frequently in trouble for one reason or another, because I also had strongish personality for a boy of my age, and talk too much occasionally. But this class of destroyer was interesting, the tribal class. We'd started the war with 16 of them in two flotillas, the 4th flotilla and the 6th. Tartar was part of the 6th flotilla. they'd already started to have terrible casualties in the Mediterranean, particularly, and of course helping wherever they were, because they were the most powerfully gunned ships. They were very fast. I believe they can do 35 knots or 36 knots. And we were running out of small ships to do things, so they were required everywhere. So casualties were beginning to mount up. I don't know how many were afloat when I actually joined, but I do know, and it'll be covered by some of the events to be described, that by the time I left at Christmas, just after Christmas in 1942, there were only four still afloat out of the 16 we'd started with, and that there was only one still running, and that was Tata, because the others all had actual damage.
Now, could you describe, I mean, you were gunnery officer, what guns did you have and what was your role as gunnery officer?
We had twin 4.7s in A gun and B gun and Y gun, and a twin 4-inch at X gun. My role as gunnery officer was to control the fire of all those guns.
And how did you do that?
The ship was fitted with a gunnery director, two gunnery directors, one for surface action and one for anti-aircraft action. The anti-aircraft gunnery director was rather like a sort of eagle's nest, open at the top, and it had gunnery radar attached to it with a thing called an Iyagi aerial. It rather looked like the television aerials, except that they were directional. And there was a I think there were four of us in this gunnery director. The low angle director or surface action director.
How did the AA gunnery director work? Or roughly, perhaps you won't know now.
Well, if you could imagine your eagle's nest being able to rotate, there was one of them in the director who controlled where it was pointing. There was another man who could make the aerials go up and down, the telescopes and so on, which aimed the guns to go up and down, and he controlled it in azimuth, in elevation, the other one in azimuth. My role was to be in charge of what it was pointing at, when to open fire with the approval of the bridge, what sort of shells to use, whether to use barrage fire or controlled fire, at our aeroplanes particularly, but also when we were using the fused shells, time-fused shells, against other targets. If we had surface action, then we were required to climb out of this eagle's nest, go down a vertical ladder about eight or ten rungs to a steel deck, run about 2 yards to another smaller steel ladder going up into the back end of this steel director, which had splinter-proof plating. The idea being that if there were splinters flying around, you would last longer in that. There were more likely to be splinters if it was surface fire than if it was any aircraft fire. Whoever worked that one out didn't actually know about warfare much. However, we only had enough crew on board to man one or the other of these directors. So if we were fighting a battle against aeroplanes and something appeared where we had to climb into the surface director, we had to do so very quickly indeed and start controlling the guns in a slightly different way.
Would the guns point automatically at whatever the...
Not automatically. The guns, too, had trainers who worked it in azimuth, and elevation people who controlled it the other way. And they were behind plating, and they followed pointers. They had to align one pointer with another pointer. The pointer which they had to align with was the one which was controlled from my director, and the calculations about exactly how much they should be aimed off or was made by a transmitting station calculating down in the bowels of the ship. I had a lot to learn. I hadn't actually sat in one of these directors before I got there, and so we had a lot to learn. And I had a gunner on board who worked the transmitting station down below, and he was the expert, wasn't he? and we had gunners' mates who knew about drill at the actual guns themselves. But it was my responsibility as the gunnery officer to see that all this lot acted as a team and fitted together. And we were connected by telephones to each other, headsets and voice pieces in place. The process of actually getting there from our cabins was not logical. Officers lived aft in ships, didn't they? Because Nelson had done and everybody else had done. But the controls of the new ships were no longer right aft as they had been in the sailing ship days. They were forward up on the bridge. So if you were in your cabin and an excitement occurred and you had to get to your action station, you had to run like a rigger all the way along the iron deck, which in some seaways was partly underwater. And you had to do so as quickly as you possibly could and then go up these vertical ladders, sometimes covered in ice. And you then had to get into the right one, probably being half asleep because you'd been down aft when the alarm bells went off. And you had to get there pretty damn quickly. Because there was a possibility of the iron deck being partly underwater, because the waves sloshed over it near the torpedo tubes, and you had to get along the upper deck without being washed off it, a jackstay was rigged from fore and aft along the iron deck on both sides. And running along the jackstay was a bit of rope which had been secured in such a way that it was running and something metal inside it. And you took one of these and you hung onto it with a knot in the bottom of it so that you wouldn't fall off easily. And you hung onto it with the ship moving all over the place and occasionally waves coming inboard. I wasn't one of those who was nearly washed over, but I did get wet going along there often enough. And it made the point that you had one hand for yourself and one for the Navy.
Now, what about your accommodation aboard ship? Could you describe it?
Tata was positively luxurious compared to any other destroyer I'd seen. As a subaltern, I had a cabin to myself. It had hot and cold running water, which was almost unbelievable, and a bunk, a desk, and chest of drawers underneath it, somewhere to hang my clothes as well. And it was so much better than anything else I had seen. And I also, for the first time, of course, had a servant looking after me called Able Seaman Logie, and the Ordinary Seaman Logie, that I really felt very well done by indeed. But I was the junior officer in the wardroom, and so I was very much the beck and call of everybody else. There were various rather remarkable events.
Before, just a bit more, what about the wardroom? What was the wardroom, and what did it offer you as an officer, and how was it organised?
The wardroom was down aft. There were around about a dozen officers on board. We ate all our meals there. It had the usual wardroom wine bar available. There was a limit to what one could normally drink, but most of it was common sense. But there was, I believe, an official limit of how much you could spend a month. But it wasn't a really large sum of money, but you have to offset that against the fact that gin was costing a penny a time and beer was too expensive.
Did any officers aboard have problems with drinking, or was that...?
Occasionally, I think everybody had problems because they were frightened, overtired, and when you got away from the stress and relaxed, sometimes they did have a party, yes, rather, or they had it ashore and came back mildly pickled. Sailors, too, occasionally shared their rum ration, and if having had their rum ration, they then went ashore and drank the Red Infuriator available in the markets in Northern Africa, you occasionally had problems with that too, but I think it wasn't peculiar to our ship. This was common to every ship. The wardroom itself was interesting in that only three officers played bridge. The captain also played bridge and liked playing bridge. Now, the captain had been a member at White's. The engineer officer had regularly paid his mess bill at Kiam when he was learning to be an engineer officer by playing good bridge. And the Lieutenant RNVR, called Andrew Aikman, had, I think, been a commercial traveller or something, and was also a very good bridge player. And I was the only other one in the wardroom who admitted to playing bridge at all, and I wasn't in their league. So when we played, I was passed around like a bad smell from one to another as a partner. And they were of such high quality that we would make our bids in contract bridge, and then the first card would be played, perhaps by me, and I might play the two of clubs or something. They'd say, oh, well, that's it then. We can't possibly go on. I said, but why? They say, but you played the two of clubs, and you called three hearts, or whatever it was. And I was not really up to their standards, and it was very tiresome indeed.
Did you get better?
No, not in their standard, not up to their standard. I didn't. I think they longed for somebody else to join who could play better bridge than I could. But it wasn't a frequent thing that happened, just enough to be thoroughly embarrassing from my point of view. But there were other scenes which occurred occasionally in the wardroom, and I was occasionally in trouble in that ship too. Let's start with our very first job after working up.
Well, tell me what working up was first.
The officers and ship's company had never worked together before. They were all new in the ship. They had to be turned into a team, and the system had to be quite certain that we were efficient. Efficient at running the ship in the routine sense, that the engines had to work properly, the electrics had to work properly, etc. That we knew what we were doing from the gunnery point of view. We knew what we were doing from the anti-submarine point of view, and from the torpedo point of view, because we had torpedo tubes amidships as well. The process had to be done under pressure, partly because there was a shortage of time, and partly because those responsible for working us up had to know that we would continue to make sense under pressure, because when you go into action, you are under pressure. So it was a time without much sleep, with an opportunity to make a pot mess without it being too awful. But nevertheless, it was fascinating to me because I had been a games player. I was a natural team person for that reason. And I felt that my guns were going to be a first-class team and was very keen indeed to make them so. We therefore set off, having completed our working up, in a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, not longer, I suspect, we set off for the Mediterranean.